There's help for businesses too. Employers' national insurance contributions will be removed for those aged under 21. For small companies, the rate relief scheme will be extended and business rates will be capped at 2%. Labour's Ed Balls said he welcomed the upward revision of the growth figures, but maintained his accusation that the recovery was only for the rich and ordinary people were still feeling the pinch.
After three damaging years of flatlining, the slowest recovery for over 100 years, from a Chancellor and Prime Minister who said we're all in this together and then gave a huge tax cut to millionaires, Mr. Speaker.
But this Chancellor is nothing if he's not political. And amid all the numbers, he laid a clear trap for Labour. A commitment to put his deficit reduction plans to a parliamentary vote this time next year as an updated charter for budget responsibility. So, 6 months before the election, Labour will have to choose to either back George Osborne's plans for debt and borrowing or vote against them and let the Conservatives tell everyone that Labour is against balancing the books. Tonight, Labour said they had no problem with supporting the idea of falling debt.
The Office for Budget Responsibility, which produced the forecasts underpinning the Chancellor's statement, believes the budget will be in surplus in 5 years' time. It wouldn't mean the government had paid off its debts, but over the course of a year it would be spending less than it had received. Our business editor, Robert Peston, examines how that could be achieved.
What's really striking in the OBR's forecast is that it says government's consumption of goods and services, or day-to-day spending on public services and administration, will shrink by 1919 to its smallest share of national income since at least 1948. Now, this shrinkage is because, on the OBR's analysis, around 80% of its forecast reduction in public sector borrowing is accounted for by lower public spending, by what we've come to call austerity. Now, to be clear, these are predictions, not this moment's reality, and they would require a government after the 2015 election to stick to this administration's targets for taxing and spending. But it shows that if George Osborne were to remain Chancellor after the election, the austerity would roll on. What about the issue of more immediate concern to most of us, the strength and durability of the recovery? Well, on this, the OBR is downbeat, much more so, for example, than the Bank of England. The OBR points out that the first serious growth the UK has enjoyed since 2008 is being fuelled by what it calls the unexpected strength of private consumption, which has largely come from lower saving, not from higher income. So households whose finances in the round have still not been adequately mended are spending money they don't have. And the OBR also fears that the underlying growth rate of the economy or the UK's prospects to improve output per worker have been worsened since the crash and won't recover anytime soon.
The UK Independence Party has accused the Chancellor of creating a debt time bomb. Its city spokesman is Stephen Wolfe.
This was simply a budget for politicians and not for people. This is a Chancellor that is running out of ideas, and quite frankly, he's got the wrong priorities. He's already accepted that he's borrowed £198 billion more in this Parliament than he said he would, and he's 4 years behind his own plans for the deficit.
The SNP said the Chancellor had failed on every single target he had given himself. Elvin Cloyd, an MP for Plaid Cymru, was concerned that the recovery was limited to London and the South East.
The national insurance holiday to bring youngsters into work, that's not at all a bad idea. And also increased anti-tax avoidance measures. All these are for the good. I do think that's right. But overall, the problem we have is that there is considerable growth where we are now, but in other parts of the UK, it can't be seen anywhere.
The increase in the retirement age outlined in the autumn statement means that as many as 10 million people will have to work longer before they can collect their state pension. The delay is designed to reduce the cost of paying pensions as life expectancy increases. Our personal finance correspondent, Simon Gompert, has been considering how the changes will affect the working population.
The pension age is being raised in stages. Those in their mid to late 50s will have to wait until they're 66, around 52 and under, and you're looking at picking up the state pension at 67, and now the Chancellor's brought forward a move to 68 by about 10 years. So those in their mid to late 40s and under, a group of as many as 10 million people, will have to wait an extra year. He's created a rule of thumb that no more than a third of adult life, measured from the age of 20, should be spent in retirement at the taxpayer's expense. There'll be an independent body which will have the job of calculating exactly who will see their pension age raised as lifespans continue to grow. It'll seek to give at least 10 years' notice of further changes, so in theory, the goalposts could be moved yet again. Mr. Osborne said those in their mid to early 30s and younger will have to wait even longer. Their pension age is now penciled in as 69. Pension experts are warning that people in their early 20s today may have to wait until they're 70 to qualify.
As the Chancellor delivered his assessment of the economy, the Bank of England announced that it was keeping interest rates at the historic low of 0.5%. The bank's quantitative easing programme, which injects money into the economy, has also been kept on hold. The Work and Pension Secretary, Ian Duncan Smith, has told BBC News that the Universal Credit Programme may not be completed by the end of 2017 as planned. He said some people receiving employment and support allowance could be transferred to the new benefit system later. In September, Mr. Duncan Smith told a parliamentary committee that the 2017 deadline remained in place. Labour has described the announcement as shambolic. Our political correspondent Ross Hawkins reports.
Universal Credit has been dogged by concerns that its computer system was untested, its project management was flawed, and its political support was draining away. But Ian Duncan Smith has insisted throughout that the programme would be complete by the end of 2017. Now he has told the BBC that the job could take a little longer. Around 700,000 of those receiving a benefit that supports ill and disabled people, perhaps a tenth of the total caseload, may not be moved onto the new benefit system in time. Mr. Duncan Smith said the official in charge of the programme may want to take longer to deal with a vulnerable group of claimants. The Department for Work and Pensions said most people would be moved onto Universal Credit as planned, but Labour said the government had failed to get a grip on welfare reform.
Police have charged a man tonight with the attempted murder of two police officers in connection with a shooting in Leeds. James Leslie will appear before magistrates in the city later today. The High Court in London has ordered that a Royal Marine convicted of murdering a wounded insurgent in Afghanistan should be named. Sergeant Alexander Wayne Blackman will be sentenced in the morning. In the city, the 100 share index ended the day 11 points lower at 6,498. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones was down 68 points at 15,822. On the currency markets, the pound lost nearly half a cent against the dollar to $1.63. Against the euro, sterling was down slightly at €1.21, making a euro worth 84 pence. Cricket, Australia's captain Michael Clarke has made a half century as he and Brad Haddin continue their partnership at the start of the second day of the second Ashes test in Adelaide. A short time ago, Australia were 313 for 5 in their first innings. The headlines again. A powerful storm that swept across Britain has killed two people. The Chancellor, in his autumn statement, has insisted that Britain's economic plan is working well. And our main news tonight, the death of Nelson Mandela, the prisoner of apartheid in South Africa who became the country's president. He was 95. Although Nelson Mandela was renowned across the world, it's in his native South Africa that he'll be most mourned. His achievement was to deliver a multiracial democracy against tremendous odds. James Robbins was in South Africa as BBC correspondent for Mr. Mandela's release from prison in 1990. He's been speaking to South Africans who were inspired by Nelson Mandela's example.
Nelson Mandela gave an entire nation its freedom, freedom from decades of tyranny and rigid racial segregation. But to understand the staggering scale of that achievement, I went looking for a few South Africans, black and white, each of them inspired, touched and changed by Nelson Mandela. First in Soweto, I met the girl in the picture. The picture is one of the most famous photographs of anti-apartheid struggle. It freezes the screaming moment in June 1976 as Antoinette Peterson, schoolgirl, runs beside the boy carrying the body of her brother, Hector Peterson. He's just been shot and killed by the police, the first victim of the Soweto uprising against white domination. A museum about apartheid was named in her brother's honour. Antoinette worked there for a while, struggling to confront her grief. She only succeeded by thinking of Nelson Mandela's suffering.
I never thought I would talk about what happened on the 16th of June, really. I never thought, because every time I spoke about it, I just become traumatized, confused. So I said, but Mandela went to prison for 27 years and he kept on going. Why can't I do the same?
At the other end of this vast country, South Africa, at the heart of the Cape Winelands, I met Herman Bailey. In the new South Africa, he rose to be mayor of Paarl. Under apartheid, of course, Herman, classified Cape coloured or of mixed race, could never have been mayor of any wealthy town ruled by the white minority. Herman salutes Nelson Mandela's leadership and also his great forgiveness when he was released from more than a quarter of a century in jail.
Well, I think it's the values of the man, Nelson Mandela. To have been incarcerated all those years and to come out, and in his very first speech he said, let bygones be bygones. I think no South African who was at the time very influenced by the then government could have believed that this is the words of somebody who's been incarcerated for so long.
Next to Genadendal, or the Valley of Grace. Further east in the mountains of the Cape, the first Christian mission station in South Africa. It was established here in 1738. This is a community which staunchly resisted apartheid, causing Nelson Mandela to name his Cape Town home, Genadendal, after the village. Chris Wessels was pastor of the church here until his retirement, a hugely respected figure, not least because he too was imprisoned in the 1970s for daring to oppose white supremacy. 69 days in solitary confinement almost killed him. Nelson Mandela's example kept him going.
I just got the feeling that I would never come out alive. Sitting there with my thoughts, I thought, I wonder what Nelson Mandela was doing at that time. Having been there for so many years, separated from his family, how he could endure such torture, to be separated from the community for so many years. Here I sat for only a few months, and yet it was so hard, it was so difficult. It was practically unbearable, and that gave me strength.
Our last witness to Nelson Mandela's greatness is a woman, a white woman, an Afrikaner, who used to believe he was a terrorist to be feared, not admired. As a schoolteacher at John Orr High School in Johannesburg, Hedwig van der Merwe's pupils were exclusively white until the mid-1990s and the end of apartheid. But she rejoices in the change to multiracial education, even while she remembers her own past fear of that change, her fear of Nelson Mandela himself.
Was it going to be safe for white South Africans? Will we be able to move around the way we used to? Are we now going to be thrown into jail because we're white? He started talking and sort of reassured people that this country is now going to work together. And there's never, ever going to be a thing like apartheid in South Africa. That set our minds at rest.
The testimonies of ordinary South Africans to a most extraordinary South African. Together they speak for a nation Nelson Mandela did more than anyone to change utterly.
James Robbins reporting. BBC News.
With Luke Tudnam. In view of the news from South Africa, there will be some schedule changes tomorrow. You'll find full details on the Radio 4 website. Also on the website, you'll find a wealth of archive material on the late Nelson Mandela. Just go to the BBC homepage and search for Mandela Archive. Now, let's get the latest on the weather. Here's Chris Fawkes.
Thanks a lot, Howard. And Thursday was obviously a very stormy day. The strongest winds recorded was in Al-Hara in Highland Scotland, 93-mile-an-hour gust here. There was a disruption to power supplies and also transport networks, the roads, rails and airports struggling in places too. It's also set in motion a storm surge, a bulge of water that's been working down the North Sea coast. And where, combined with the local high spring tides, we have seen some really quite nasty-looking flooding problems. Indeed, the local Environment Agency latest figures say there are 64 severe flood warnings currently in force, the bulk of these across the East Anglian area. So we are not out of the woods from this, so we are going to see further coastal flooding problems, even across the southeast of England as well. Now, weather-wise, overnight tonight, it is going to be a cold night with a reasonably widespread frost developing. The lowest temperatures are likely to be into the highlands of Scotland, where temperatures could get down to minus 8, minus 9 Celsius as the winds continue to ease. There will be further snow showers in Scotland, a wintry mix for the showers. showers moving into northwest England, northwest Wales and on towards the Midlands as well. Could leave us with some ice problems first thing Friday morning. So for Friday's weather forecast, across England and Wales, well, eastern areas having a cold start to the morning, but it should be bright and sunny. It will tend to cloud over, and that cloud trapping cold air near the surface. So across the East Midlands, northeast England, temperatures only get to around 1 Celsius or so, maybe 6 degrees in the London area. For Wales and southwest England, well, it will turn cloudy quite quickly. That cloud bringing slightly milder air, temperatures 7 degrees, outbreaks of rain pushing into the northwest of England. For Northern Ireland and for Scotland, it's going to be a cold start to the day. We'll also have a little bit of rain moving in, perhaps a bit of snow for a time too. That's the latest weather. Howard.
Many thanks, Chris. Chris Fawkes with the weather. We'll have the shipping forecast in just a few moments, but in the meantime, we're sailing by. BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 6th of December. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Etzira, South Etzira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover, Irish Sea, Malin, Hebrides, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, Sweden, 961, expected Lithuania, 970 by 1800 Friday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Etzira, South Etzira, northeast 40s. Northwesterly, severe gale 9 to violent storm 11, decreasing 6 to gale 8. Showers, moderate or poor. Southwest 40s, Cromarty, Fawn, Forth, Tyne, West Dogger. Northwesterly 7 to severe gale 9, becoming variable 4. Showers.